So last time I had just started talking about quantization of a massless scalar field with this action in a non-dynamical de Sitter spacetime, given in this form where I'm using conformal time tau instead of proper time t. This is kind of a warm-up for inflation, where the spacetime will be, the background will be quasi de Sitter, and the metric will also have dynamical degrees of freedom. I'm going to do one little, before I talk about quantization, I want to do one little algebraic step just to make the analogy with the time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator clearer. That is switching variables from this field phi to the canonically normalized field psi. Canonically normalized just means that so I'm going to define psi to be 1 over h tau times phi. Canonically normalized concretely just means that the coefficient of phi dot squared in the action is 1/2, as would happen in a Minkowski spacetime. So I'll make that change of variables. I'll write this out just to do an integration by parts. So the time derivative of, if I write phi equals h tau psi, then when the time derivative of phi appears in the action, that's h psi plus h tau times del psi d del tau. So putting that in here, you see that we get some extra terms from the product rule. In the next step, I'll just reorganize those a bit. So this first term is the expected kinetic term proportional to psi dot squared. Then I get some terms with one time derivative. The term with zero time derivatives appears in the mass term. It's like mass proportional to 1 over time squared. I'll integrate by parts to move this derivative over to here, say, picking up a minus sign, with one extra term. We'll just write out the result. So the cross terms with one derivative can be eliminated by integration by parts. And it changes this coefficient of 1 to a 2. So with the action in this form, each k-mode of the canonically normalized field psi looks just like the action that we had for the harmonic oscillator last time, with a frequency given by omega squared equals k squared minus 2 over tau squared. This specific tau dependence comes from the de Sitter expansion history. As in the example of the time-dependent harmonic oscillator, the equation of state approaches a constant k. Sorry, the frequency omega approaches a constant k at early times, but becomes negative and large at late times, which is kind of unusual. But there's no real problem with it. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about quantizing the theory with the action in that form. And so I'll sort of do this side by side with a simple harmonic oscillator. Just to show that there's no new conceptual ingredients. It's just the same story with an extra k index. Let's see. I'll start by writing down the action. So here's the action I considered before. And then this QFT example, I have this action. The next thing I'm going to write down is the canonical commutation relation. So just to do that in a systematic way, the momentum conjugate to x is the derivative, defined as the derivative of the action with respect to x, and so is x dot for the oscillator. And similarly, because I canonically normalized, the conjugate momentum to the field psi is the partial derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of psi. And so that is the partial derivative of psi with respect to conformal time. I'll put the k's on there just to make it complete. The significance of that quantity is that when we quantize and promote these variables to operators, we want the we expect the canonical commutator of x with p to be I. Or in this field theory context, the commutator of psi with its canonical momentum to be I times the momentum conserving delta function. With a plus sign here because I didn't put a dagger on either of these operators. Another way of thinking about the plus sign is that it's just, if I were to do the canonical commutator in real space where each of these fields has a coordinate x and y, then I would get a delta function in x minus y. And if you Fourier transform that, you end up with k plus k prime. Okay. I think this step, I'll describe this as an optional step, but just for the sake of completeness, I decided to write down the Hamiltonian. So in classical mechanics, it's just x dot p minus the Lagrangian, which in this case just has the effect of flipping the sign of the potential term. So write that as p squared over 2 minus t squared over 2 squared. Analogously over here, if I wanted the Hamiltonian in field theory, let's define this way. Take the canonical momentum and multiply it by the time derivative of the field minus the Lagrangian. If I wanted the Hamiltonian, I could write it this way. Switching to Fourier space for writing the result would look like this. The other thing that I did here is wrote the Hamiltonian in terms of the momentum field instead of psi dot. Okay. To quantize the theory, I want to propose expressions for psi hat and pi hat, which satisfy the canonical commutator and the operator equations of motion. So the Heisenberg picture equations of motion for these free theories there are no ambiguities with operator ordering, and the Heisenberg equations of motion for the operators are just the same thing as the classical equations of motion. And so for the simple harmonic oscillator, the operator equations of motion that you're trying to solve are just given by this. To solve the theory in the Heisenberg picture, you need to solve these operator equations of motion. And then analogously in the QFT, I just want my operators to satisfy these equations of motion. Del psi, I'll write them in Fourier space. And the derivative of k is squared like it. So if you wanted to be like super systematic, you could derive these by applying Heisenberg's equation of motion given this form of the Hamiltonian and using the canonical commutator to do the commutators which arise. I left that step out because we saw for the harmonic oscillator that you just end up with the classical equations of motion just with reinterpreted with operators. And the same thing happens here. Okay. So to quantize the theory, I just need to write down some expression for operators x hat and p hat that satisfies these differential equations and the canonical commutator. And so we showed for the simple harmonic oscillator. Today I'm just going to sort of think of it as an ansatz. But last time I talked about how you might see this in sort of a ground-up systematic way. So let me just write out the solution. Dot t plus dot t star a dagger, where a and a dagger. So last time I was writing these with zero subscripts to emphasize that they're the latter operator is in the initial state before any time evolution takes place. Not Schrodinger picture operators defined relative to the Hamiltonian at some later time, or Heisenberg picture operators which have different time dependence. So from now on, I'll use the notational convention that latter operators are just written without subscripts and are understood to apply at the initial time. Where u of t is the mode function, which is the solution to this differential equation, the classical equation of motion, with an initial condition, which is kind of non-trivial. It's the initial condition is that if the angular frequency omega goes to some constant omega naught at early times, then the mode function should do this at early times. So this is the solution of the theory in the Heisenberg picture. If you wanted to check that, if this was just written down as an ansatz, then you can easily verify that these equations of motion are satisfied and that the canonical commutator is also, canonical commutation relation is also satisfied. The last step is a bit non-trivial, so let me write that down. So the canonical commutator of x hat with p hat Last time we wrote that out and found that it was given by this so-called Wronskian determinant. And then we had to argue that this was equal to I for this to be a successful quantization of the theory. You can show that by first showing that the time derivative is equal to zero. That follows from the equation of motion. This particular choice of initial condition tells you that the Wronskian determinant is equal to I at the initial time. That's enough to show that it's I at all times. We had kind of a longer argument for why the initial conditions took this form. If you forget the longer argument, you can just, as long as you remember that the frequency here has to be negative, there's the coefficient of the e to the I omega naught t term is zero, then you can recover this constant from the canonical commutation relation. The QFT version of this is very similar. It's just, I'm just using the ladder operators that have a k subscript. So the psi operator at time t will be some mode function. I'm going to write the mode function as u sub psi k tau. Just to remember that this is the mode function that applies to the canonically normalized field psi. Times some annihilation operator AK. Next I'll put U psi one way of thinking about the second piece is that in the simple harmonic oscillator case, I wanted X hat to be Hermitian. And so I needed this term because it's the Hermitian conjugate of the first term. In Fourier space, a classical field is not a real quantity. Rather, its complex conjugate is the psi field evaluated at minus k. When I quantize, I want the operator psi hat k to be the Hermitian conjugate of the, let me write it this way. The Hermitian conjugate of psi k should be the field operator at momentum minus k. Enforcing that condition gives you the minus k here on the creation operator. Pi k. The right-hand side for pi k hat just follows from the Heisenberg picture equation of motion that says that it's the time derivative of psi k. So I'll just put dots here. The initial time operators AK and AK dagger satisfy the usual commutation relation for ladder operators of a field. Continuing the analogy, the differential equation satisfied by the mode function is u double dot psi k tau minus. At early times, should approach 1 over 2k to the 1 as tau goes to infinity. I think that the for me, the most subtle point in all of this is getting the right initial conditions. The way that I like to remember them is just that Yeah, so it's I think it's important to say in this example that at early times, when tau is close to minus infinity, then this 2 over tau squared term goes away, and you just have the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator at frequency k. And so if you remember that you just have negative frequency modes in the initial conditions, then you can recover the coefficient if it's in this example, it's kind of obvious what it is because the field is canonically normalized, so you can just appeal to the harmonic oscillator result. But if it weren't canonically normalized, then you could infer the coefficient by demanding that the commutator of psi with pi be I times 2 pi cubed plus k prime at early times. Okay. So one difference compared to the simple harmonic oscillator case is that previously I was leaving the form of omega of t unspecified, but here I have a specific tau dependence in mind, and so I can try to solve the differential equation. And it's very useful to know that it has the exact solution. Equals over 2k to the 1/2, 1 minus I over k tau, 1 minus I k tau. So this is the analytic form of the mode function in a for a massless scalar field in De Sitter. Let me say that this is sort of hard to find. Not a totally trivial differential equation to solve. I'm not sure what the right way is to solve the differential equation, but one way is if you so if you change the coefficients here a bit, like if you change the 2 over tau squared to some other value, then what you get on the right-hand side here isn't a simple analytic function anymore. It's some Hankel function times a prefactor. And so this differential equation perhaps is best thought of as Bessel's differential equation after a change of variables. And it happens to be the case that for the Bessel function that you get in this case, h sub 3/2, there's an identity that shows that it's of this form. That's something that you'll work out on the problem set. Okay. So one thing that's a little weird about this mode function is that it looks divergent at late times. As tau goes to 0. And that's just an artifact of the canonical normalization. It's in the original field variable. Phi equal h tau psi, then you could write the operator phi hat this way. Where I've just defined this definition is also true if I put after quantizing, after I put promote phi and psi to operators, where I've defined the phi mode function to just be the psi mode function multiplied by h tau. And so that could be written this way. Generally speaking, it's easier to use the canonically normalized field psi at early times. There's no divergence as tau goes to minus infinity, but there is a divergence as tau goes to zero. And it's easier to use the phi mode function at late times where the opposite is true. I guess one really minor comment is that I dropped an overall factor of minus I here, since the overall phase of the mode function doesn't matter. It's equivalent to changing the phase of the wave function, which is arbitrary. Okay. As another comment, I won't go through it all in detail, but you could choose to quantize the theory in the original field variable phi. The change to the canonically normalized field psi isn't really necessary. Then you'd get a different classical equation of motion, Heisenberg picture equation of motion for the operator phi hat. You get a differential equation. You would find that this is the solution. And then you just would need to figure out the coefficient sitting in front here. That step is a little bit less straightforward, since you can't just appeal to the analogy with the harmonic oscillator for a canonically normalized field. But you can infer it from the canonical commutation relation if you write it out. I won't write through all the details, since I think they're a bit of a distraction. I just wanted to comment that you can quantize the theory in whatever field variable you prefer, and you should get a consistent result. Okay. So I think I said last time that my goal was to compute the late time two-point function. Or the expectation value of two phis. Let's see, to be totally precise about that, I'm going to take the two phi operators to be evaluated at the same time. But I'll allow them to have different wave numbers. I'll take the limit as tau goes to zero at the end. Okay. So now I have explicit expressions for these operators in terms of ladder operators applied to the initial vacuum. One assumption that I'm smuggling in here is that I'm assuming that the system starts. So at very early times, when for all wave numbers of interest, these terms proportional to 1 over tau or 1 over tau squared are small, then this theory just looks like a massless scalar field in Minkowski, a massless free scalar in Minkowski, the usual particle creation operators. I'm assuming that I start out in the vacuum state of that theory with no particles. So that's what's called the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So there's one sort of hidden assumption floating around in my treatment of inflation, which is that at early times, when the field doesn't feel the de Sitter expansion yet, and just thinks that it's a free massless scalar in Minkowski, it just starts with no particles, as opposed to some other choice of initial vacuum state. I think that's just a choice, sort of a hidden choice in the theory of inflation. And there are papers that explore other interesting choices of vacuum. So making that choice, I'll compute this vacuum expectation value by substituting in my expressions for these operators. So let's see. So for the first operator, I'm using the mode function U phi. And then For the second operator, I get the same thing, but I am allowing a different wave number, k prime. K prime dagger. I can get rid of this term because an annihilation operator applied to a vacuum ket always gives zero. Analogously, I can get rid of this term since a creation operator multiplying on the left a vacuum bra always gives zero. So let me write the result this way. Just keeping the one term out of four. And in the next step, I'll plug in the explicit expressions for the mode functions. This gives h over 2k cubed. And then for this expectation value, you get just a momentum conserving delta function, 2 pi cubed times delta 3k plus k prime. So then in the last step, I'll take the limit as tau goes to zero. So I'll set k equal to k prime because of the delta function. And then I'll also set tau to zero to get, can everyone see if I write at this height on the blackboard? Times 3 plus k prime. Say as tau goes to zero. So in my discussion of inflation, I said that one of the things that I wanted to explain is how inflation plus quantum mechanics naturally predicts a two-point function, or a power spectrum is the name for the two-point function in Fourier space, whose k-dependence is proportional to 1 over k cubed. That's the so-called scale-invariant power spectrum. When we get to inflation shortly and the dynamical metric, you'll see that it's possible to produce an exponent here which is slightly redder than 1 over k cubed, meaning it has a little more power at low k. And that is something that's actually demanded by the observations. The amplitude of the scale invariant power spectrum is h squared. Meaning that the characteristic size of the fluctuations in the phi field that are quantum mechanically produced is of order h. Phi is a field with dimensions of mass, so I should get something with the only scale floating around is h, the Hubble expansion rate, the de Sitter expansion rate. So this is a really fundamental result that if you put a massless scalar field on a de Sitter spacetime, you don't end up with zero fluctuations at the end. You end up with some quantum mechanically produced random fluctuations, which have a scale invariant k dependence and a characteristic size of order h, the de Sitter expansion rate. So then. basically ready for inflation. The Mukunov-Sasaki action that we wrote down a couple lectures ago is it's not really more complicated than a massless scalar field in De Sitter. Before I go on to the next example, which is a little closer to inflation, would anyone like to ask any questions on the on this material, on the quantization of the massless field in De Sitter?
I have a question. So
yes.
Second to last line.
Yes.
It's exponential to the minus ik tau minus tau prime. What is?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, thanks. I should have written. K minus k prime times tau. Thanks.
And so as tau approaches zero, that means that's the time when inflation ends?
Oh, yes, yes. Somewhere, I think I just erased it, but the De Sitter space-time in conformal time, the De Sitter scale factor looks like 1 over h tau. Where the conformal time runs from minus infinity to zero. In conformal time, the De Sitter spacetime has the property that the past horizon is infinite, but the future horizon is finite. And so it's convenient to just choose the like zero point of the conformal time so that the spacetime ends at tau equals zero. So tau is always negative, and you'll see some minus signs appearing like in this expression for A of tau. Yes?
So far we did the background solution for the field that does not depend on space, and we got the scale invariant power spectrum.
Yes.
And now is the idea that we're going to consider space dependence of the fields to find corrections to the k to the power of 3?
Oh, yeah. So in this example, the metric is non-dynamical. And so the metric just doesn't include quantizations, doesn't include fluctuations that get quantized or spatial perturbations. But the phi field is like fully perturbed and quantum mechanical. So in this example, there's just there's no like gauge symmetry. There's no coordinate reparameterization invariance. And there's just one physical degree of freedom, one dynamical degree of freedom, the scalar field phi. In inflation, there are three dynamical degrees of freedom, and the counting of degrees of freedom is a little more complicated because of the gauge invariance. Okay, those are really good questions. Are there any more questions on this example? Okay, cool. So then I actually kind of like so it turns out that when you do an inflation, there are a few dynamical degrees of freedom, and each of them behave as a massless scalar field in a some sort of FRLW background. So I think it's a little more convenient before going straight to inflation to do something. It's almost the same as the De Sitter case, so I'll just sort of sketch it. The main difference is we won't have an analytic expression for the mode function anymore. Okay. So I just want to talk about what happens if we take the same action as before, a dynamical scalar field on a non-dynamical metric. But instead of assuming De Sitter, I assume some general scale factor A of tau. we'll be interested in the quasi-Sitter case where the equation of state is close to minus one and a of tau is like slightly sub-exponential. Okay, so you can either so plugging in the FRW metric, I can write the action this way. So you can either quantize the theory using psi, quantize using phi, or the canonically normalized field psi, which is A times phi. And so, as before, I'll denote the corresponding mode functions by U sub phi and U sub psi. So these are just some functions which satisfy the same equations of motion as the field modes. They're just just have to remember that they're not modes of the field. They're the coefficients of these raising and lowering operators. I'm actually going to write the equation of motion twice. So if you use the canonically normalized field psi, then this is the differential equation. So instead of the 2 over tau squared that you I got in De Sitter, I get the second derivative of A over A. In terms of the phi field, if I want to use the phi field, then the equation of motion looks like this. Squared U phi. With some factors of 1 over h tau just generalized to factors of A. So I'll be interested in the quasi De Sitter case. In that case, at early times, it's simpler to use the psi field. I'll generally use the psi field at, it's more convenient at early times. And the phi field tends to be more convenient at late times. So for a general FRW expansion A of tau, I think there's not much to say about these differential equations, except to say that maybe you could try to integrate them on the computer if you have some complicated A of tau. In the case where the spacetime is close to De Sitter, you can make some simplifying statements. One simplifying statement is that in the quasi-De Sitter case, at early times, the psi mode function just looks like a simple harmonic oscillator. This term is small. For the De Sitter case, it went as 1 over tau squared. So one thing that's true is that at early times, the psi mode function becomes simple. We can read off what the initial conditions are? As always, if you remember the negative frequency condition, you can recover the prefactor from the canonical commutation relation at early times. And then another thing that's true is that at late times, you can show that the phi mode function becomes constant. Its derivative goes to zero. In the De Sitter case, you can read off that behavior from the mode function. I guess that's not totally obvious. If I, you might think that there's a term here proportional to 1 power of tau, but if you Taylor series it out, it goes as 1 minus 1 half k squared tau squared plus terms of order k tau cubed. I forgot to tell you what late times and early times mean. In a quasi-De Sitter spacetime, so the quantity 1 over ah, I'll call that the co-moving Hubble radius. So it's so this is the co-moving distance that light travels in a Hubble time. If it were just 1 over h, it would be the physical distance that light travels in a Hubble time. So in a quasi-De Sitter space-time, that's a rapidly decreasing function of time. If I want to draw this as a straight line, I guess I need to say that the time axis is log a. This axis is log r. Generally speaking, if w is less than minus 1/3, then you can show that this co-moving Hubble radius is a decreasing function of time. And so then there's one other interesting co-moving scale. If I'm analyzing the behavior of a mode function, then the other interesting co-moving length scale floating around is just the co-moving wavelength, or 1 over the co-moving wave number of the mode of interest. So generally speaking, late and early times are defined relative to this time, which is what's called the horizon crossing. So if I'm interested in, if there's some wavelength, co-moving wavelength of interest, like if I'm integrating the differential equation for a mode function at some k, what happens is that at early times, the characteristic length scale of the spacetime, or the co-moving Hubble radius, is much larger than the wavelength of interest. And so the mode doesn't feel the expansion of the universe and just thinks that it's a field in Minkowski. That's the regime where the psi mode function just oscillates as a simple harmonic oscillator. At late times, I'm in the opposite regime, where the co-moving Hubble radius is much smaller than the wavelength of the mode. The mode just gets frozen in. physically a mode with, so let me write that the mode function here becomes constant. So you can think of that freezing in as either being due to Hubble friction, once the k squared becomes small compared to the Hubble scale, then the field is pinned in place by Hubble friction. Or you can think of it as sort of like causality, like if the fluctuations in the mode have a wavelength which is much larger than the Hubble radius, then there's no way for the mode to know that it's not part of the background, so to speak. Like in one Hubble time, like there's causality prevents this part of the mode from talking to this part of the mode and knowing that there's anything spatially fluctuating to evolve. So the interesting physics happens here at horizon crossing, where this is kind of the only time when the behavior of the mode isn't just sort of prescribed somehow by the asymptotic behavior. So the reason that I'm drawing this picture is that I want to motivate the following ansatz. So I think this is something that's like very hard to see directly from the differential equations. But it makes intuitive sense given this picture, that if the FRW background is quasi-de Sitter, then at late times, the mode function approaches H over KQ. Where I'm using the notation H star to be the value of H at horizon crossing. Where K is equal to AH. The time when these two quantities are equal. The physical argument for that is that if you imagine, so I've argued that all the interesting physics has to happen within a few Hubble times of horizon crossing. A local observer which just observes the mode function for a few Hubble times around a horizon crossing doesn't see enough of the expansion history to know that they don't live in a de Sitter spacetime. H is nearly constant in a few Hubble times. They would see a mode function come in with the usual oscillatory behavior exit with the usual constant behavior. The constant value must be the same as the value of H in this window. Many Hubble times before horizon crossing or after horizon crossing, the value of H may differ, say by order one, from its value here. But it's just the value at horizon crossing, which is setting the value of the mode function. I find that physical argument pretty convincing. I don't know of a analytic argument. It would be nice to complement that physical argument by an analytic argument based directly on the differential equations, but I don't really know of a simple one. I think I'll just leave the physical argument and come back and assume this in the next lecture. We actually covered quite a bit of ground today. This result is a good place to leave off. We showed that for a massless scalar field in a non-dynamical FRW background, you will get some let me just finish this thought. So it's it's also true that the power spectrum at late times approaches h squared over 2k cubed with a star. And so this can have a little bit of extra scale dependence on top of the 1 over k cubed. Because if I if I change the value of k, if I make it a little bit bigger, say, then I change the time when horizon crossing occurs. And so the h squared here evaluated at horizon crossing is evaluated at a slightly different time, where its value would be smaller. In general, h is always a decreasing function of time. Okay. So next time we'll talk about, go back to single field inflation. We'll take the Mukhanov-Sasaki action. We'll find that all the different dynamical degrees of freedom have an action which is exactly of this form, just with some different expansion history A of tau. And so we'll be able to use this result to read off what late time power spectrum is produced. Okay. Any questions on any of this before we break for next time? Yes, yes.
Is there a reason it's called horizon crossing at the value?
Oh, yeah. It's supposed to evoke, you know, if you imagine some co-moving horizon, which is just distance that light travels in a Hubble time, then that's a rapidly shrinking function. And so if you're interested in a Fourier mode of a field with some wavelength, like there's some time when those two scales become equal. I suppose you could also think of it, another thing that's true is that because this horizon, so in this picture, this wave is supposed to be the wavelength 1 over k of a field mode. And the circle is supposed to represent the co-moving horizon 1 over ah. I suppose another thing that's true in a quasi-de Sitter spacetime is that because this is a rapidly decreasing function of time, it also represents the total distance that you'll ever be able to send a signal in the future. So horizon crossing is sort of the time when if you release a light ray today, then it can never travel one full wavelength of the mode in the future. So the different parts of the mode, like the positive part and the negative part, have become causally disconnected from each other. I think that's a physical way of thinking about why the mode can't oscillate anymore and the mode function gets frozen in at a constant. Because the positive and negative, the mode can only oscillate if there's an inhomogeneity. If the positive and negative parts of the mode are not in causal contact in the future, then there's no way for the mode to know that it's inhomogeneous and have time to oscillate. Yes, yes.
K is a wave number, and then so you can change the like your wave number for each mode. There's a different wave number. So like for a smaller wave number, the horizon crossing happened at later times.
So for smaller wave number or longer wavelength, the horizon crossing would happen at earlier times.
That's k to the minus one. Okay.
Yeah, I flipped up. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I thought it was more intuitive to make the y-axis a co-moving distance rather than a co-moving wave number. So I'm comparing 1 over ah to 1 over k. Okay.